Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of today's show, we'll be bringing you a story about one of the worst pharmaceutical disasters in U.S. history. It happened 50 years ago, in 1955, when at the height of the polio epidemic, a laboratory in California, this was Cutter Laboratories in Berkeley, mistakenly produced a vaccine, a polio vaccine, that contained the live polio virus. As a result, 70,000 contracted polio, 200 were paralyzed, and 10 died. We'll be bringing you the story this morning in this part of Focus as we talk with Dr. Paul Offit, author of the book The Cutter Incident, the subtitle How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to the Growing Vaccine Crisis. The book is published by the Yale University Press. And indeed, in the book, as he tells the story, he also makes the argument that the cost to the country of this event was enormous, and in fact is still being felt today as the lawsuit that resulted discouraged companies from developing and producing new vaccines. Just a little bit more about our guest. He is an expert on the subject of vaccines. He is chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and professor of Immunologic and Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He is also professor of pediatrics at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and has done a lot of interviews, is often quoted in the news on the subject of vaccines and their development, and recently why it is that we have shortages of vaccines. As we talk in this first part of Focus 580, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana. Even people listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Offit, hello. Just hold on a second. We need to, now I think we got the right button pushed. Dr. Offit.
Yes. Good morning.
Good. Good. Glad to have you with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
I think it would be interesting to start out, as you do in the book, for those people whose memory of polio is dim, and there will be a lot of people who might be listening to us or could be listening to us this morning who were born after the vaccine was available and who don't really think about polio much at all, it's good probably to remind people just how frightening this was to people at the time.
Yes. You know, if you look in the 1940s and 1950s in the United States, there would be 30, 40, sometimes 50,000 cases of polio a year. You know, the virus, you know, typically entered the body, went to the bloodstream, and then traveled to the spinal cord where it caused ultimately paralysis, typically of the legs, sometimes of the arms, but and often 80% of the time the paralysis was permanent. And further, you know, the virus could affect the muscles necessary for breathing, causing children to be in these so-called iron lungs. Some of them, you know, are even alive today as adults, still in iron lungs, but typically children died in the iron lungs at the time from pneumonia. It was a terrible disease. And what was worse is it didn't really affect it the way you think. It didn't affect the way that you understood your environment. It just affected your ability to move, and it was a very emotional disease.
Mm-hmm. That's why there was so much excitement. It was such good news when the word came that Jonas Salk had developed a vaccine, which appeared to work.
Yes, I mean, you know, there were ticker tape parades, and there were, you know, church bells, you know, rang out, and synagogues and churches had special prayer meetings, and people hung banners from their stores saying thank you, Dr. Salk. It was, as I said, just a phenomenally emotional disease, and you know, people were so glad to have that vaccine that they felt it was as if a war had ended.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that entire books have been written about Jonas Salk and the effort to develop the vaccine, but maybe you can talk just a little bit about what it was he did and why it was that his technique, that is to take the virus, to kill it, inactivate it, and then use that as the vaccine so that then the body would recognize the virus, develop antibiotics, antibodies to it, but not get sick. Why it is that that very idea of using a killed virus was at the time revolutionary. In fact, I think when he started doing it, the prevailing thought in the within medical research was you actually couldn't do it. It couldn't work that way.
Yeah, I think the prevailing thought was that it wouldn't work for long. That if you were going to be protected for the rest of your life against polio, you had two options. Either you could be naturally infected with polio and hope that you got, you know, a mild or asymptomatic infection and that you weren't paralyzed but that you would still be protected, or that you could receive a live, weakened form of the virus. And ultimately, that was the vaccine that was developed by Albert Sabin. I mean, people didn't believe Salk, that his inactivated vaccine would provide lifetime immunity. But certainly, I think we've learned over the decades that he was right.
The technique that he used, what he did was he had animals that were infected with the disease. They're infected with polio, essentially. And I know this is a gross oversimplification, but infected with polio, he used the animals to produce the virus so he could get enough of it. Then the technique was to take the animal tissue to grind it up so that you could then get the virus. The virus was then killed with formaldehyde. And the big catch here, where the problem came in, is that you had to make sure that you filtered out any residue of animal tissue that might be in the product, because the problem might be that there would be little bits of virus that would be hiding there in the tissue that would never have been exposed to the formaldehyde, which was the killing agent. And so you would end up ultimately with a vaccine that still had live virus in it. He had one way of doing this, but the problem came when large pharmaceutical companies started to have to produce large batches of the vaccine, because obviously there was huge demand. People wanted it. They wanted lots of it. They wanted it now. And that's where the problem came up.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. By the time Salk actually was doing his work, which was in the late 40s and early 1950s, we'd actually gotten away from using animal tissues per se, meaning inoculating the animal and then grinding up their tissues. We actually would take, in his case, you know, monkey kidney cells and grow them up in sort of the bottom of laboratory flasks. Then he would grow the virus, and then the key step came, just as you said, in once he'd grown the virus in these cells, to try and separate the virus from this kind of cell debris that was there, because only then and only then could formaldehyde appropriately enter the virus and kill it. Otherwise, the virus would sort of hide in the cell debris, and that's what happened. I mean, although Salk was able to make thousands of doses in his lab and show that the vaccine was safe and that it worked, when we got to large-scale mass production, the filtration at mass scale became more difficult, and, you know, Qatar certainly suffered that the most.
Mm-hmm. And they weren't the only company.
That's right. I mean, if you look through the Freedom of Information Act, sort of provides one document, you can see that all five companies had problems in activating the virus. I mean, although only Qatar had as big of a problem as they had, Wyeth also made, which was in Marietta, Pennsylvania, near here, they also made a vaccine that caused paralysis and some death in the Northeast. So Qatar had the biggest problem, but certainly the notion of inactivating a vaccine completely was still a process in evolution.
Mm-hmm. The process that Qatar and other labs were using, this was as far as the United States government was concerned, as far as standard scientific practice was concerned, everybody at the time thought, or did everybody at the time think, that this method that they were using should have been fine. No one really thought that the filtration process would be imperfect and that you would end up with vaccine that had live virus in it.
Right, and you know, they were coming off of a big polio trial that was done in 1954, where Eli Lilly and Park Davis made, you know, roughly 400, almost 500,000 doses of vaccine for that trial, and that was a very carefully run, carefully observed trial where the vaccine was safe. And I think that provided a sense that now these other three companies that came in, which was, you know, Qatar, Wyeth, and Pittman Moore, would also be able to make a vaccine that wouldn't be problematic. That wasn't true. Two of those three companies also had a problem. They were smaller companies, and you know what happened then is something that could never happen today, is that vaccine was licensed and then marketed from those three smaller companies without ever having been tested in large numbers of people. You could never do that today.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take for doctors to realize that something was wrong, and that people who were getting the vaccine and then developing polio didn't just get it it wasn't just a chance matter of, yes, they got the shot, but maybe they already had been exposed to polio. How long did it take them to figure out, no, in fact, that it was because of the shot?
Yeah, as quickly as it could have been, actually. I mean, within about 2 weeks of the mass administration of that vaccine, Cutter's vaccine especially, there started to be cases of paralysis that occurred. Now, this was April, and April in California, at a time several months before when one would have expected to see polio. And two, children were getting paralyzed in the arm that was inoculated, which was another hint. And three, it seemed to be all those cases of paralysis were initially occurring in children that just received Cutter's vaccine, even though they actually had distributed the least amount of vaccine in the country. So all those things were worrisome enough that the government really within about 24 hours pulled all of Cutter's vaccine off of the market. And a couple weeks later, actually, when they realized that manufacturing this vaccine wasn't as easy as they thought, for a week they pulled all polio vaccine off the market. I think many people forget that happened because, you know, the polio vaccine has been such a tremendous success. But I guess like all things in medicine, this was a process of evolution. And given, you know, what happened with Cutter Laboratories, it was a painful one.
Yeah. Well, given though that, given all that, it sounds as if you would have to say that the response was in terms of recognizing there was a problem and then recalling the vaccine and making sure that we weren't continuing to give it out. Actually, the response was pretty good.
It was excellent. I mean, I think the government very quickly identified the problem, figured out what the source of the problem was, and made the kinds of changes that they needed to make, not just in terms of manufacturing, but in terms of vaccine regulation within a matter of months. I think that the government actually acted very responsibly. You know, ultimately, it pushed vaccine regulation out of its infancy. At that time, only 10 people within something called the Laboratory of Biologics Control at the National Institutes of Health regulated vaccines. Within a couple months, that number increased more than 15-fold.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Paul Offit. He's professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Medicine. He's also chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and professor of immunologic and infectious diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The story here that we are discussing is contained in his recent book. It's titled The Cutter Incident, How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to the Growing Vaccine Crisis. And it does indeed refer to these events that happened in the spring of 1955, when this laboratory, Cutter Laboratories in Berkeley, produced, by mistake, vaccine, polio vaccine, that ended up having some live polio virus in it. And as a result, some of the people who were vaccinated developed polio. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone listening here this morning over in Indiana who has a question. We'll go right there to the toll free line four. Hello.
Hello. I guess you've been sort of bouncing around the central issue. First, a little preliminary. After I graduated, and I did some quality control work in various manufacturing places, and I know for a fact and anecdotally that the economic side of manufacturing usually wins the game whenever something comes up in regard to quality. They oftentimes pay a heavy price for it, but a lot of times they sneak through for a few months, and then they get their act together, and then things get straightened out. When David announced what was going to be on this morning, first thing that came to my mind was that wonderful O-ring with the rocket, where they just assumed that freezing would not affect the O-ring. And, of course, Feynman did, you know, one of the simplest experiments that caused some of the most extravagant ripplings through the scientific community and the engineering community when he put it in a glass with ice cubes and it became brittle. And my question is, a very cynical one, where's the paper trail? What did they actually do? Was it just a case of brand new information and we don't know really what to do? Or did they make some, let's say, economical decisions to cut corners? Thanks.
All right.
Yeah, I don't see any evidence that there was a decision made to economically cut corners in the hopes of making more money. I mean, this was it was a different time in the mid-1950s. I think there was a real effort to try and make a polio vaccine and make it well. I think what happened was there was sort of a series of about seven things, all of which had to go wrong in order for Cutter to make the the terrible vaccine they made. I mean, I think, frankly, every dose of that vaccine was contaminated with live virus. And it was a combination of using a filtration method that wasn't very good, although Qatar wasn't the only one that used that same filtration method. Park Davis also used that same method, the so-called glass filtered or sintered glass filters, without a problem. The safety test that you have, which is basically you would take your vaccine and you would inject it into the spinal cord of a monkey, or you would take your vaccine and you would inoculate it onto monkey kidney cells to see whether or not you'd adequately inactivated the virus, and those safety tests were just very blunt. You know, they weren't terribly sensitive, and we happened to use a very dangerous strain. Then we used the Mahoney strain, which was probably the most virulent of all the polioviruses. So there wasn't much of a safety net if you did make a mistake. And so I don't see. I mean, I think that the inactivation curves that Jonas Salk had developed in his lab were difficult to do on a commercial scale, and I think all the companies had that problem, and so they all tended to ignore it, I think, at some level. But I don't think anybody acted in any sort of knowing way maliciously. I just think it was just a terrible tragedy that shook our faith in the wonder of science, as well certainly as our faith in the federal government's ability to regulate vaccines at the time.
Mm. And I'm not necessarily here meaning to be defending the company, but I guess again I feel that you need to point out or remind people how worried we were as a nation about polio and how much demand there was for vaccine. There was a lot of pressure on the companies that were producing it to produce it and to produce it yesterday and to produce it in very large amounts.
Absolutely, and quickly. And I think, but I do think that what probably the biggest fail-safe that wasn't there were safety tests that were sensitive. We just didn't have them. Within about 2 months, that we developed a much better safety test, both in monkeys and in cell culture, that allowed us to detect much tinier amounts of live virus. But you're right. I don't think anybody acted egregiously. I mean, during the writing of this book, I talked to the time the CEO's name was Robert Qatar. His son David Qatar was very forthright with me, and I think opened up the records of the company for me to take a look at. Because I think he didn't feel he did anything wrong, and that was sort of very prevalent among all the people I talked to at that company who were associated with the manufacturer of that vaccine. They were as surprised as everybody that this had happened. There was no sort of smoking gun or evil man, you know, with a trench coat lurking in the shadows here.
Yeah. The second sort of big part of the story, the one that also has implications now for us today, it comes when we move into the lawsuit phase, because indeed a family of a girl who got the vaccine and developed polio decided to sue. To sue Qatar, with the assistance of a man who was at the time probably the most famous personal injury lawyer in the country, and is still a name that people will remember. They were represented by Mel Belli, and they took the suit to court. And the important, I guess you can tell the story a little bit more fully, but I guess the important thing was that the court on the one hand decided, the jury on the one hand decided, that there was no negligence. Nobody willfully did something wrong that ended up with bad vaccine. But at the same time, they decided that the company was liable. And that's has affected the vaccine, production of vaccine and companies that do it and companies that would even think about it to this very day.
You're right. That's an excellent summary. What happened when Mel Belli sued Qatar Laboratories is he sued them on two counts: one, that they were negligent, and two, that they, meaning which is that they didn't exercise the ordinary care in the production of that vaccine. And the jurors just didn't buy it. They saw that all the companies were having trouble inactivating virus. They saw that Wyeth also made at least one lot of vaccine that paralyzed and killed children, and they interpreted correctly that this was a process that was still in evolution, and that Qatar shouldn't be blamed for a process that was still in evolution. But they were also sued on this count of something called breach of implied warranty, which is it's implied when you buy a vaccine that says inactivated polio vaccine on it, one, that it doesn't contain live virus, and two, that it doesn't cause the disease that it's intended to prevent. And the judge really forced the jury. He sort of directed the jury to find Qatar liable, saying if you find that this vaccine caused harm, then you have have to find the libel. And they really resented it. They wrote a very long explanation of why they didn't agree with being directed in that way. But you know, the Pandora's box was opened. And now you had the birth for pharmaceutical companies of liability without negligence or liability without fault. And that meant that from that point on, when jurors considered cases against pharmaceutical companies, they no longer had to consider whether or not the company was negligent in production or design. They only had to determine whether or not the company was whether, in fact, the product did cause harm. And I argue in certainly the last third of this book that that decision, I think, has been tremendously damaging to pharmaceutical companies. I think, more importantly, has been damaging to the society that benefits from the products made by pharmaceutical companies.
Mm-hmm. Because your argument is that companies, they look at the cost and potential liability, and they say, yes, we could make this product, we could make vaccines, and maybe we could make money doing that. But on the other hand, if there's any sort of problem, then we're liable. We could be responsible for having to pay out enormous amounts of damages. And so for that reason, we're going to say, we're just not going to take the chance. We're not going to go into that area.
Right. I mean, on the one hand, you could argue that the notion of holding companies absolutely liable for their products is not a bad thing. I mean, why should Ann Gottschnack or the girl who sued Cutter Laboratories have to pay liability, have to pay insurance, you know, against getting polio when she gets a polio vaccine? I mean, isn't the company in the best position to essentially buy that insurance for her by passing off the cost of that insurance that they're going to pay to everyone who benefits from the product? I think at its heart, that's a very nice notion. It just didn't work out in practice because, on the one hand, there was no limit to what one could sue. I mean, you have companies that will lose a half to two-thirds of their capitalization associated with the harm caused by their product. And two, and I think most importantly, there were because jurors now are responsible for determining causality and they can be bad at it, you would have a lot of products that are claimed to be harmful that in fact weren't harmful. I mean, were perfectly safe, but jurors found them to be unsafe. And I give a number of examples in the book of products that were perfectly safe, that studies showed them to be safe, but you know, but the plaintiff's lawyers, the personal injury lawyers, were very good at making a case in court and convincing jurors, you know, to make the incorrect decision, which ultimately hurt and sometimes ended that company.
Mm-hmm. You want to actually go ahead and give some examples?
Sure. I mean, probably the best example was there was an anti-nausea drug that was on the market in the United States from 1950s into the 1970s called Bendectin, which was like a very simple product. It was just vitamin B6 and an antihistamine. But pregnant women took this drug and it was used in up to 40% of pregnancies. It worked tremendously well to prevent a pretty annoying disease, which is morning sickness in pregnancy, something that can cause dehydration, water loss, and hospitalization, occasionally death. Charlotte Bronte actually died of morning sickness. But so the drug worked, and there had been, at the time that the first lawsuits came, claiming that, you know, my child, you know, had developed birth defects because the mother took Bendectin. Mother takes Bendectin, child, you know, gets delivered and has, you know, mild birth defect or severe birth defect, and now it's a matter of whether you can convince a jury that those two things were causally related. And, you know, there were 27 separate studies at the time that showed that the incidence of birth defects in children whose mothers took Bendectin was the same as in children whose mothers didn't take Bendectin. But, you know, of the 12 cases that went to court initially, five of them were found on behalf of the plaintiff, the child who claimed to have the defect. And that ultimately caused that drug to be taken off the market. The incidence of birth defects, you know, of birth defects remained unchanged, stayed at the same 2% it always was. And the incidence of dehydration and water loss and hospitalization secondary to the to not having an effective drug for morning sickness, you know, caused the hospitalization rate to double for these women. And in fact, the drug has never been replaced. I think probably the most telling comment that was made when this was all done is the president of the company said, you know, we would suggest that if you're nauseous in the first trimester of your pregnancy, that you call your lawyer.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Paul Offit. He is an MD doctor. He's professor of pediatrics at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He's also chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and professor of Immunologic and Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and is an authority on vaccines, and is the author of the book The Cutter Incident, How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to the Growing Vaccine Crisis. It is published by the Yale University Press, and tells a story that took place 50 years ago when this laboratory, Cutter Laboratories in Berkeley, California, and that's where the title of the book comes from, ended up producing vaccine, polio vaccine that had live virus in it. And a lot of the people who got the shot got sick, some got paralyzed, some died. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to talk with in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I know you. This is a case study of this particular incident, but you're trying to draw implications from it for the vaccine industry and the pharmaceutical industry. Seems to me, I just heard somebody was saying, well, we need to indemnify the vaccine industry so that they can make the avian flu vaccine, and even just the flu vaccine seems to be in short supply again this year after having the problem with last year. You're trying to draw some implications on that. It seems to me the pharmaceutical industry already gets a whole lot of largesse from the government in a variety of ways, being able to take over the intellectual property of research areas like in Maryland, and et cetera, et cetera. So it just seems to me that really quite a bit of a broader perspective it seems to be necessary, a real public health model as opposed to what we have now. And another thing is, I wonder whether you looked also into the swine flu episode, because there were consequences with a syndrome, Guillain-Barré syndrome, after that vaccination, and that was done in kind of similar circumstance to what we might imagine with this announcement of, what, $2 billion of money into vaccination that was just announced today. So could you sort that out for us a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I think that that's really good questions, and the two points you make are linked. If you looked at what happened to vaccines after the door that was kind of opened by the Cutter lawsuit, they really were unaffected. I mean, from 1955 to 1975, difficult vaccines continued to be made, and I think medicine was still allowed, I guess, the process of trial and error, which was unfortunately a requisite, I think, in medicine, without consequence. That all changed, actually, in the late 70s and early 1980s, when there was a flood of litigation directed against the makers of pertussis or whooping cough vaccine. That vaccine was claimed to cause everything. I mean, sudden infant death syndrome, permanent brain damage, including mental retardation, seizures, this disease called Reye syndrome, unexplained.
This is the mercury tamoxifen.
No, this is well before that. This is independent of that. This is just the feeling was that the whooping cough vaccine was causing children to be permanently brain damaged. Now at the time, and really since then, there have been about 15 studies that have tried to answer the question: did children who used the whooping cough vaccine, or were they at greater risk for developing these diseases which were claimed as compared to children who didn't use the whooping cough vaccine? And the answer was no. I mean, the vaccine didn't cause permanent brain damage, but it didn't matter in court, because what happened in court is companies were successfully sued again and again and again until you went from 8 pertussis vaccine makers to 1 pertussis vaccine maker, and there was a lawsuit that was successful that was basically for about half of the entire pertussis vaccine business. And what companies in the United States said is, we're not going to make vaccines anymore. We're out. And vaccines became the first medical product almost eliminated by lawsuits. And the company responded appropriately and quickly in 1986 by creating something called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which basically indemnifies isn't exactly the right word, but it protects companies from frivolous litigation associated with vaccines. What it does is there's basically a 75-cent excise tax, federal excise tax, on every dose of vaccine. It goes into this big federal sort of pot of money. And if someone claims that vaccine caused, let's say that the influenza vaccine, which contains egg proteins, caused severe allergies, they'll get compensated by that program. But on the other hand, if somebody claims that the MMR vaccine caused autism or that thimerosal vaccines cause autism, they won't get compensated by that program, because there's abundant evidence, scientific evidence, that disproves those. So I think it's essentially the vaccine court, and I think that saved vaccines in this country. And your statement, which is a good one, I think, or question is a good one, about, to what extent should companies be indemnified or protected in the same manner from frivolous litigation or even appropriate litigation regarding avian flu vaccine. These companies won't make the vaccine unless they have that. And that's what happened with swine flu, if you remember. Swine flu was a vaccine that was introduced in 1976. It was given to about 40 million people in the United States, and roughly 400, well, roughly 1 per 100,000, developed this Guillain-Barré syndrome. Because there was something indemnified in place for that, the companies were protected from getting hurt by that litigation. I think as they should should have been. I mean, it was an unpredictable event, and so that's the question. I mean, should if a company tests something thoroughly prior to its release and it's tested in 20 or 30,000 people and is not found to cause harm, but then when it's put in 20 to 30 million people, it's found to cause harm. And you know, the response to that is to try and essentially burn the company down, which is, I think, what we do to some extent with, you know, with Merck relating to Vioxx or Wyeth related to Fenfen. And who benefits from that? I certainly don't think society benefits from that.
Well, I think I have a contrarian point of view on this because it seems to me that we have evidence that it wasn't done in good faith with Merck. I think they should have punitive damages myself if they suppressed information that they had. And that's, you know, I think that's the bad faith that we're dealing with partially in this. And I think you better acknowledge that because, I was actually looking towards a broader, maybe public health model. Canada seems to be having a success in actually vaccinating more percentage of their population for simple flu than we are, and I just, you know, I think giving Merck as an example is a bad one for your case because they are implicated in actually having bad faith and,
I'm not
practice of research. So I'm not sure. It's a very complicated issue, but
I'm not sure we'll figure this out because I think both of us are sort of stuck with the same amount of information, which is that we know what we read in the newspapers. I think that at least my interpretation of what happened with Merck is that they, they had a signal early on. So in the first three studies that they did with Vioxx, they had a signal that there may have been a problem. And they took that to the FDA and they hired an external advisory panel to say, is this that our drug is causing heart attacks, or is it that because we have naproxen as a control that we're just not preventing heart attacks? And I think they questioned it right from the beginning, and they went to the FDA right from the beginning. I think, you know, what happened is, and maybe, you know, you see what you want to see, but I don't think they ever knowingly tried to hide those data.
I guess that'll be sorted out, but at some point, and maybe by other people than us. But I was taking NSAIDs, and I had a prescription for Vioxx the week that the thing broke, and I got my money back on it. But I understand the complexity. But I still think we just need some kind of public health model where the as long as this medical industry is an industry and that profit is the main motive, there are going to be people cutting corners, I'm afraid. And,
you know, I agree with you, actually. I think certainly if there's evidence that data are misrepresented or that the company is lying or acting egregiously, I think there has to be some punitive way of making them pay for it so that they learn not to do that again. I certainly agree with that. I do think, however, that the way that lawsuits have worked in this country regarding pharmaceutical manufacturers is it swung wildly in the other direction. I do. I don't think, as long as the model, and you're right, I mean, it's a public health model, as long as the model is that pharmaceutical companies are making the drugs that make our health better, I think we have to find a better way to deal with them than the way that we currently deal with them, which is with these sort of massive class action lawsuits that I think drive them to these bigger and bigger products and, frankly, away from things from which we benefit.
I want to jump in here. I got another caller, but I guess I want to ask you in a direct sort of a way the what do we do about it question, simply because we know that, you know, in medicine there are always going to be bad outcomes, sometimes in spite of everyone's best efforts. And particularly if we're talking about developing new medical technologies, I think the other thing that we know, although we probably don't really like to think about it, is that by the time something has been tested and is released for general use, we still really don't know what it's going to mean until we go beyond from having maybe tens of thousands of people take it to having millions of people take it. And there's still the possibility that there's going to be bad outcomes. So what do we do to try to compensate and take care of the people who suffer the bad outcomes?
Here's my fantasy, right? I'm going to give you my fantasy, David. The vaccine court, which I think largely works, I mean, has on the one hand been able to compensate people who are harmed by vaccines quickly and generously and fairly when it truly is causal. But on the other hand, I think has protected companies from frivolous litigation. I think that's a model for, and although there's some weaknesses in this program, I think it's generally a model for tort reform. I mean, you could argue that this vaccine court could be applied to drugs. So here's the model. One, for eliminate direct-to-consumer advertising. I think it's money ill-spent. I would much rather see the company spend money on research and development than on convincing me that their products are safe and effective. Two, it also creates this notion of this sort of wonderfully safe drug. And I think, people then don't understand that everything that has an effect can have a side effect and know that everything is an issue of risk-benefit. I don't think those commercials help with that. Two is, I think, do the same thing for drugs that's done for vaccines. For every dose of Nexium or Vioxx or whatever people are taking, that there's money that's set aside as a federal excise tax that goes into this kind of drug injury compensation program. So that when there is a problem, and Vioxx certainly was a cause of arrhythmia, and I think the data were there, as we know retrospectively, I think the data were probably there a few years ago. So now because it's in 20 million people and not 20,000 people, now you know it's a problem. So instead of burning the company down and making a lot of money for personal injury lawyers, why don't we then have this essentially drug court where people are given, the same amount of money that they're given in this vaccine court, which is, $250,000 to $500,000, which is seems reasonable. I mean, I don't know, one doesn't know what a life is worth. And I guess, if you die of an arrhythmia in Texas, you from Vioxx, you get $253 million. And if you die in Iraq serving your company, country, you get $12,000. And I don't know what the answer is, probably somewhere in between those two things. But it's certainly the sky is the limit is not the way to do this. And I think that went by sort of burning down these companies or significantly limiting their capitalization and not allowing them, I think, in many ways to make the drugs we want them to make, that we suffer that. And maybe by saying, look, if you do this way, forget direct-to-consumer advertising, we'll set up this drug court, and we will have a system whereby we can pay people who are hurt or compensate people who are hurt. And then, as your previous caller said, I do think there still has to be a system whereby you can punish companies who are shown to act egregiously. Then I think we would be better off. And then maybe we can go to them and we can say, look, in exchange for this, and I'm sure they'd love this program, in exchange for this, you need to focus more on these kind of orphan drugs like vaccines or antibiotics, which have sort of fallen in disfavor because they're small market products, in favor of, the fifth lipid lowering agent or the 10th potency product. I just don't think I don't see how society benefits from that kind of structure.
We are moving into our last 15 minutes, so we have a caller we'll get right to. Again, our guest is Dr. Paul Offit, professor of pediatrics, University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He's author of the book, The Cutter Incident, How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to the Growing Vaccine Crisis. It's published by the Yale University Press. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to call. We have someone in Chicago on our toll-free line. They're next. Right here. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Within the last 2 weeks, on the news, once only, I heard that 4 cases of polio in the Amish community, and it was only once it was heard, and then nothing after that. Was that a false alarm, or was that all about?
You know something? I couldn't agree with you more. It surprised me the degree to which the media ignored the story that for the first time in 26 years, we saw polio again in the United States. It was in a group of Amish folks who lived in Minnesota who
yes.
chose not to vaccinate their kids. And these 4 cases, although the vaccine, the virus had the capacity to cause paralysis. Actually, all those 4 children who were affected didn't get paralyzed. But certainly the capacity for that virus to spread into the surrounding community and cause harm is there. I agree. Why didn't the media cover that story?
That's a puzzle. I heard it one time, and it didn't even repeat the next hour or two.
I know, polio. It's back. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so fortunately, we have, in Minnesota, we have a highly immunized population, and so, the moat is around the fire, so to speak, and that virus, I think, is very unlikely to spread into the surrounding community. But, if our vaccine immunization rates decline, certainly there would be a fertile ground then for polio to come back. Because, frankly, polio exists in this world, and as long as international travel is common, we're always at risk for polio until it's eliminated.
There you go. In President Roosevelt's case, was he at the lower part of his body affected? Or?
Yeah, he was paralyzed below the waist.
Below the waist.
Right.
What was the cause of death in his case, and how...
I don't know. I don't know what he died of. I don't know.
I believe a heart attack on warm.
Was it a heart attack?
Something like that. But he sure brought polio into the news and seen him all the time in the movie.
He did, didn't he? Although it was interesting, in researching this book, I could find only four pictures of him in a wheelchair. I mean, you know, considering that he was in a wheelchair all the time, it's amazing how the press kind of respected his desire not to be shown as an invalid.
Right. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I wondered if I might ask you about a different sort of subject, and that is the big concern now about avian flu. People now have sure heard plenty of stories about this, particular virus that is passed between birds, and that we have some documented cases where humans who were in close contact with infected animals became infected, and some people have died. And the big concern is the possibility that this virus over time could mutate so that it would be more easily passed from person to person, and that people are talking about the possibility of a pandemic in that case, like that we saw, for example, in 1918. And now the president has today, I believe, presented a plan to deal with the possibility of avian flu, among other things, calling for $7.1 billion in money, emergency spending, to stockpile reserves of medicine to deal with it if such a thing would happen. And apparently so far, this particular virus, H5N1, there hasn't been any of it found in the United States, but there are a number of people who have died, actually, as a result of this. So there seems to be reason for concern. But I guess that epidemiologists and people who study disease outbreaks and so forth say maybe we're more afraid of this, or we're panicking more than we really need to be. I wonder if you could talk about the level of concern. What's the appropriate level of concern, and then how it is that we are now talking about, as a nation, preparing to deal with the possibility that we could this could be a widespread problem.
Right. Well, there certainly are things about the bird flu currently circulating among birds in Southeast Asia that's worrisome. One is that it's infected hundreds of millions of birds, and when it infects them, it often kills them. Two, it has spread to humans. So about, you know, hundreds of millions of birds have been infected, about 120 humans have been infected. And the other thing that's concerning is when humans do get infected with this virus, and they're getting infected by coming in contact with these birds, they die. I mean, about the mortality rate for this virus is about 50%, which is extremely high. So that's all worrisome. What's a little less worrisome or somewhat reassuring is that the species barriers are still very substantial. I mean, hundreds of millions of birds, only 120 humans. It's a very difficult virus to catch from birds. Two is it just hasn't been spread from person to person. And until it mutates so that it can do that, it will never be a pandemic virus. Now, H5 viruses have been around for 100 years and have never been spread efficiently from person to person. Doesn't mean it never will, but it never has. So I think, I mean, there are many reasons to believe that the bird flu currently circulating in Southeast Asia will not mutate, because it's about 25 mutations away, which is significant, to a pandemic strain. But I think preparing for a pandemic certainly makes sense. What I hope is that if bird flu isn't a pandemic strain, people won't think, well, this whole thing about a pandemic is just hooey, and we should have never worried, because there's roughly three pandemics every century. This century won't be any different. We'll probably have a pandemic within the next 20 or 25 years. It may not be bird flu, but it will be something. So preparing for a pandemic, I think, is a good thing.
Well, do you think that it makes sense, though, to spend significant amounts of money to stockpile a vaccine that would protect people against H5N1 when it's possible that the virus that we might in a future outbreak be concerned about would be something different?
Yeah, well, first of all, you actually can't stockpile. I mean, because the fact is that the virus that you would use to make a vaccine hasn't occurred yet. Uh-huh. The pandemic strain will only be a pandemic strain when it's very efficiently spread from human to human. So if there's like an outbreak in some small province in Southeast Asia and you hear about 1,000 people or 2,000 people getting suddenly sick with what is bird flu, then you know that the pandemic has begun, and that's when you have your strain. And that's when the clock starts ticking. You get the virus, you grow it up in eggs or in mammalian cells, and you inactivate it with formaldehyde, you probably got about 4 months to do it before it spreads to this country. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we don't have a vaccine infrastructure right now to do that. So that's what's worrisome to people. But you can't stockpile H5 vaccine because for the same reason that we need to give a yearly flu vaccine. I mean, every year, influenza virus mutates enough so that natural infection or immunization 1 year doesn't protect you the next year. That's also true of H5 viruses that are circulating in Asia. The ones this year are different from the ones last year and the year before that. So we don't have the pandemic flu strain in hand yet, and we won't have it until right at the time that the pandemic starts.
All right, let's talk with some of the people here. Another Champaign County listener, line one. Hello?
Hello, this is back to an earlier conversation about the money spent by drug companies. Do you think it's worthwhile for the salesmen to come to clinics and take doctors out to lunch and give free samples and that sort of thing? Can't doctors learn about drugs on the Internet?
Yeah, I'm not sure the Internet's the best place, but I certainly agree with you that the notion of selling something, I think this is implicit in direct-to-consumer advertising. I think you're absolutely right when they're taken out to lunch or there's this notion of quid pro quo, that creates the notion that one is selling something is problematic. And so I think that you're right. Probably the best way to do this is that pharmaceutical companies make drugs that they think hopefully benefits society, that eliminate direct-to-consumer advertising, eliminate this kind of influence to doctors. It's beyond that even. I think, you know, the sort of so-called speakers bureaus, which are I think, designed to educate and arguably influence physicians, can also be problematic, that the only data that physicians get to look at are those that are published in peer-reviewed journals and that are then, you know, that they have explained to them. I think that's the best way to do it, and that there should be even like just as with the vaccine program, that there be a drug information sheet, and every time you get a drug, you get a list of what its benefits and risks are, so that you're fully informed about what those are. So it won't create this notion of this kind of wonderful product that's this risk free, because nothing's risk free. And I think maybe that will, in itself, cut down on the lawsuits, but people have a more realistic idea of what drugs really can and can't do.
The story of the Qatar incident, I don't know if it's correct to say that it was forgotten, but it's maybe in large part forgotten. What was it that got you interested in going back and doing research on this?
I think a couple things. One is it was just such a massive biological disaster. I mean, the notion that 70,000 people got a mild form of polio and that a couple hundred were paralyzed and 10 were killed by a vaccine, it was just striking to me. And basically, I just wanted to find out what happened. I wanted to find out what happened in Qatar laboratories that could allow such an awful event to occur. Because on the one hand, I couldn't believe that, you know, that anyone in the company would in any way have had any sense that this was about to happen. And I wanted to believe that was true. And certainly from everybody I talked to and all the records I looked at, that was true. And I guess that did make me feel better. And also, it was the birth of many good things. I mean, certainly the birth of vaccine regulation. It was in many ways the birth of the Epidemic Intelligence Service at the CDC. So it was the birth of good things. And I guess I just wanted, as a scientist, I just wanted to find out what exactly happened at Qatar Laboratories to allow this horrible tragedy to occur. It was just the same reason I love science. I guess I just wanted to know what happened.
Yeah. Qatar is still in business. They're now owned by Bayer. So the company was certainly not driven out of business by the judgment against it. And in what way did that verdict affect Qatar Laboratories?
Well, there were actually about 60 lawsuits against Qatar. Qatar had, totaling about $3 million. This was in now the mid-1950s up into the early 1960s. The insurance companies paid for about $2 million of that $3 million liability. The company paid for about $1 million themselves. They thrived. I mean, they, over the next 20 years, did very well. They actually were the original developers of the medicine we know as Excedrin. And they also did a number of innovative things. I mean, they thrived, and in many ways, you know, although I guess we don't like to hear this, you know, society did benefit from their thriving. They created products from which we benefited. Today, obviously, I think if that same event happened, you know, Qatar would be, you know, the Qatar executives would probably be taken out and publicly shot, and, you know, we'd all feel better for it. But the company did succeed, actually, after that.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of damages did individuals who were involved in legal actions against Qatar, what did they get out of it, and what did it mean for them?
Well, it's The woman that I focus on in this book, who I interviewed extensively, is a woman named Ann Gottsnacker, who lives in Lancaster, California. And she was, you know, permanently paralyzed below the waist. Obviously, it significantly affected her life. And she was the first case and received tens of thousands of dollars in compensation. But, you know, did that compensate her for what was, you know, a lifelong paralysis? Of course not. Is she still sort of angry at what happened to her? She is. But I mean, you know, like I think many polio victims, she saw this in some ways as her fate and has tried to make the best of it. I one thing that I guess I learned in interviewing some of these people is that, you know, they're just heroes to me. I mean, they try so hard to deal with the hand they've been dealt. It's really quite ennobling.
We will have to leave it at that. If you want to read the story, the book is The Cutter Incident, How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to the Growing Vaccine Crisis. The book is published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Dr. Paul Offit. He's chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and Henley Professor of Immunologic and Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also professor of pediatrics at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Offit, thank you very much.
Thank you.